Doherty. I'm Garrett Kaester, your host. You are listening to Canada's All Environmental News Hour. We will be discussing a number of interesting topics today. First off, at the top of the show, we'll be hearing from Adria Vassal, who is, of course, the author of the Ecoholic column in Now Magazine, a series of Ecoholic books. We'll be talking to her partially about her newest book, Ecoholic Body. She is also, after the interview I pre-recorded, told me that she's going to be sending us two copies of the book. One is for me. You guys can't have that one. However, the other one is up for grabs. So as soon as I actually physically have that book in my hands, we will be giving it away on the show. We've got some amazing music again today, programmed by our friend DJ Amber Waves over at Open Till Midnight Music Blog. We're also going to be discussing some more Doha stuff as well in the middle of the show. I've got Leah Mazzolini as well with me as my co-host in the studio today. Good morning, Leah. Oh, Mike isn't on yet. That's okay.
Hello.
There we are. And Michael, of course, our technician, maybe joining us as well at some point. We'll see if he has anything to add to our discussion. But good morning, Michael. So what we're going to be doing after that, the reason I was introducing them was we'll be kind of using the meat of the show today to talk a little bit about Doha, but also I have a couple of clips that I pulled off YouTube, one that made me really happy and one that made me really sad. And we're going to talk about those. We're going to maybe let you guess which one's which. I think you may find it pretty obvious, but we'll find out. Those are both having to do with fossil fuels and oil. Then we're going to be hearing from Dr. Mary Brunig at the end of the program. She is an associate professor of recreation and leisure studies at Brock University, and we're going to be talking to her in part about her Alternatives Journal article, but mainly about her research, which has been looking at correlations between education, mostly for younger students, and how that correlates to respect and responsibility for nature and that sort of thing. So that's another interesting topic as well. However, without further ado, we're going to go straight to our first interview, then we'll be back to talk about some news headlines. But right off the bat, this is Adria Vassal of Ecoholic fame. So we are speaking today to Adria Vassal. She, of course, is a very well-known author of a wide variety of Ecoholic books, as well as having written the Ecoholic advice column in Toronto's Now magazine for almost 10 years and covering environmental and social justice issue in the news section for nearly a decade. Adria has also been seen on the National, CBC, News World, Canada AM, Global, and all sorts of other things, including MTV, print, radio, and on this program. This is not your first appearance. Welcome to the Green Majority.
Thanks for having me back.
So we wanted to talk a little bit about today because you have a new book that's out, and that was mostly what I wanted to talk to you about. But the issue of sort of care products, I've noticed, I don't know if you'd agree, but this seems like this isn't something that has been getting more traction in general. But let's start first with how you got onto this, because the story of cosmetics somewhat relates into how you ended up on this career path of being kind of Toronto's Ecoholic representative. Do you want to just tell that story first? We'll start there.
Well, I, first of all, did not grow up in an Ecoholic household at all. It's pretty much the opposite of Ecoholic. And by the time I was 10, well, I'd say probably like 8, 9 years old, I was sneaking into my older sister's, stuff and just putting on her makeup and, getting her Nair hair dissolver and amassing as many weird, makeup collection kits as I could from the drugstores in Montreal where I grew up. And I never really thought too much about it until it was probably a couple years later. My family moved to Toronto, and I was in my mid-teens, and I, had started becoming an activist, but I had never really thought about the products that I put on my body. And I started, trying to stay away from products tested on animals and that kind of thing. But then started reading the ingredients and realizing there's a lot of unpronounceable stuff in my shampoo. and then looking around and realizing, oh, there are alternatives out there. There are natural options out there. And it seems like I could pronounce a hell of a lot more of those ingredients. And what is going on here? Do we need all these ingredients? Are they necessary? And for me, it just really became more and more apparent that we didn't need a lot of these chemicals because, for one, I grew up in a house where we may not really have been, my family might not have been early Ecoholics, but my mom was always crazy allergic to fragrance, and she would get migraines from perfume. And my older brother, who worked for Greenpeace when I was a teenager, he started developing chemical sensitivities as well and getting all kinds of headaches from, laundry soaps and that kind of thing. So it just, it started snowballing for me, and I just started realizing, wow, there is a lot of hidden crap in these products that we do not need and really aren't healthy for us. And that got the ball rolling for me on the green body care front. So once it got time to, you know, thinking up the third Ecoholic book after the original Ecoholic and Ecoholic Home, I realized there is a lot more to say on the body front. You know, in the first Ecoholic book, I talked a little bit, probably about 20 pages on body care products and so on. But with this book, I realized there was so much more to say, you know, related to all things body related inside and out. And for me, coming from a family that we did a total 180, you know, we, like I said, did not grow up in an Ecoholic household at all. My parents did not brush our teeth in apple cider vinegar with, you know, baking soda and wash our hair with apple cider vinegar. But that totally turned around for us, and we all changed our products over. We all started switching our ways, and I think that, like, my family can do it, then really anybody could. But it also made the project of writing Ecoholic Body really, like, a family affair. I could get my whole family testing products and telling me what they think and helping me out, especially with my health chapters, because Ecoholic Body isn't just about, you know, the products we put on our body. I talk about the products we put in our body, so... Mm-hmm. Since my older sister is a doctor who focuses on holistic care as well, and my little brother is a supplements advisor, and my older brother, who's passed away now, he was a herbalist, and so it was really a family affair working on Ecoholic Body for sure.
Mm-hmm. So that's something that rings true for me personally as well in my own journey, which is that, you know, when you get to care products, I mean, and now I'm at the area where I've bought, you know, almost entirely chemical free, blah, blah, blah. I won't, you know, brands don't matter, but, you know, I have certain brand of this or brand of that that I like, and it's, you know, as chemically free and pronounceable ingredients as I can, specifically for things that are in highly absorbed areas. Like, for instance, something I'm more concerned with a deodorant choice than, say, you know, something else,
right,
you know, like like a cleaning rag or something like that, because yes, it's going down the drain, but this is something I'm rubbing directly into a highly absorptive part of my body. You very literally are putting it into your body from the outside. So for me, that's more of a priority. But with a lot of that sort of thing, I think your average person's reaction is, well, you know, if Old Spice was so bad for you, then I would have noticed, because I've been using it for 10 years, and my dad was using it, my grandfather was using an equivalent of it. If it was really that bad, we would have known. So aren't you guys all just kind of going nuts? How do you sort of deal with that? I mean, these are the sorts of reactions where even if people do notice a difference and they feel better or whatever, they generally don't notice until, you know, they've stopped using the old product. So how do you sort of bring people on side with this when it's sort of so hard to tell that these things aren't the best for you?
And you know what? I totally understand where people are coming from when they say, look, if it's on shelves, it should be safe. It hasn't made me or my, you know, family sick. We've all been using it forever. What's the big deal? And the truth is, yeah, the products that are on shelves really should be safe, pre-screened for long-term, you know, safety and health hazards and so on, but they're not. You know, the truth is the only thing we know is we get warned if a product has, you know, a yield sign on it with an explosive symbol, or it's going to burn you, so they tell you to put gloves on it. So you don't really see that on body care. It's more like on cleaning products. And so how harmful could it be? But the truth is the products we're exposed to every day, they haven't been tested for long-term safety. The government doesn't really pay attention to whether the ingredients are tied to cancer or not, or whether they're hormone disruptors, or whether they're tied to estrogen mimicking. And, you know, in California, they have a totally different system. In California, if a product contains an ingredient known to cause cancer or birth defects, they have to put a warning right on the bottle. And because of that, in California, a lot of brands had to reformulate because the Attorney General said, dude, you've got a carcinogen in your shampoo, and you're not warning people, so we're going to sue the pants off you. And I would love to see that system here. So people don't really know, though, that there are these ingredients in there. And if they do know, then you think, well, how bad could they be? Truth is, look, listen, you can smoke your whole life and live to be 90 years old and be no worse for wear. And then other people can be exposed to secondhand smoke and have never smoked in their life and die of lung cancer at 45. And you just don't know where your own genetic weaknesses are. And I really don't think that we need to be adding to that chemical matrix by loading our bodies down with more unnecessary toxins. You know, we'll never know. It's like our bodies are just ticking away here, and you might be susceptible and I might not be, or vice versa. But I think it's better to just reduce our load wherever we can and get rid of the toxins as much as possible. And, you know, I do feel like, you know, I feel like a lot of people will say, you know, how bad could they be? But I you will talk to people who can react right away to these things. You know, like I said, my mother who gets a headache from it, my brother who gets sick from it. And if you don't react, then you don't have that immediate incentive. But if you just start thinking of your long-term big picture and the fact that no one's testing for this stuff, no one's looking out for your back, then hopefully we can convince a few more people to get on board. And I have noticed over the years, you know, every day, every week, I get emails from people saying, I had no idea, I'm brand new to this, and I just started reading Ecoholic Body, and holy bleep, I am totally freaked out because I didn't realize I was putting all this stuff in me, and now I'm just trying to convince my boyfriend, girlfriend, father, mother to do the same. And so, you know, there's still, every day, I think more and more Canadians coming on board for this cause, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm afraid we're quickly running out of time, and the longer you're talking, the more questions I have for you. So we're gonna try and sneak this in as condensed format as possible. So rapid fire, I'm gonna shoot a couple of things at you.
Okay.
Before we have to go, one of them was your comment about people being shocked by what they read in your book. Do you find that some of the information for say the layman's for people who are new to this sort of this area that they should be interested in, but it's an area in area of interest. Do you find that people are generally shocked by this information? Have you ever found that someone has sort of said, well, this can't be true, or you know, it couldn't possibly be this bad, or I've already known about it? Do you ever get that reaction?
I do get that reaction sometimes from people saying, most people will say, wow, I had no idea, and I didn't realize it was this bad. I had heard that something about parabens not being good, but that's about it. And I didn't realize that we had so many of these chemicals contaminating our body, turning up in breast milk, turning up in our urine, so many chemicals linked to cancer found in umbilical cords, chemicals that are found in, you know, all the products that we put on our bodies every day. And, yeah, we should know about it, but unfortunately we don't. So, and I think more and more Canadians do, though, and they're spreading the word. So that's a good thing.
Okay, so rapid fire number two. You mentioned something about products being labeled and how, you know, people don't generally know because, you know, a cleaner, for instance, will have an acid drop symbol for the hand or any of these things, and that generally, you know, care products are not. Do you know, or if you don't know for sure, would you say in your opinion that there would be a large amount of body care products that if they were held up to identical standards as, say, household cleaners, would have a variety of those warning labels on them?
Oh, they would definitely have the warnings that you would have to see in California if you, you know, were to actually examine these products, because there are a hell of a lot of carcinogens that we know for a fact are in sudsing shampoos and your body wash and your shaving cream. They've been tested to be in there, and yeah, we would definitely have these cancer warnings if someone was doing the testing here in Canada. So, I, you know what? I mean, I wish I kind of had some stickers. I should put some stickers on my website and people could go slap some of these cancer warnings on, you know, Tresemme Natural Shampoo, for instance, was just tested to have some. And they're a brand that calls themselves natural. So, yeah, this is the stuff I talk about. The brands that should have cancer warnings on them that don't. And then who are the good guys that you can actually trust?
Well, if you do an edition two of a version two of Ecoholic Body, perhaps you can release a special edition that has some outlines of how you would identify which chemicals are, like, you know, dangerous to your skin or carcinogens, and it can come with a little fold-out panel of stickers that people can go and do it, so that they're labeling them with the appropriate warning sticker. We wouldn't want to be accused
of course,
drumming up false anger.
I love the idea, and I think stickers on ecoholic.ca would be a great idea. I do already have, by the way, a free downloadable, printable wallet-sized guide to my mean 15 ingredients to avoid. So make sure that you check out ecoholic.ca. Whatever doesn't fit into my weekly column or whatever didn't get into the book gets added to ecoholic.ca. So the mean 15 list is there. You can actually tag it on your smartphone or whatever way you want to do it, so you can actually remember which are the good guys, which are the bad guys, you know, which are the really bad ingredients to avoid. Confusing, you know, you could be out there in stores looking at ingredient lists going, I don't really remember which ones beyond maybe parabens are the ones to avoid. So print out the main 15, ecoholic.ca for sure.
All right. So we've been speaking to Adria Vassal of Ecoholic, Now Magazine fame, and of course several Ecoholic books. Adria, but right before you go, I have one last quick question for you. We saw initiatives coming up right now with environmental defense in Canada around manscaping. There seems to be a lot of additional attention on body care products these days, specifically some of it being targeted at men. It's not ED had the big campaign going on right now, but they're not the only ones. With respect to the issue of men specifically, and then as a population in general, we've been seeing a lot more, at least I've noticed a lot more, in a lot more non-specialized stores, in average convenience stores, a lot more environmental products, a lot more ones that seem to be conscious of what's in them, you know, natural alternatives, this sort of thing. In your opinion, is it mostly just that the marketing has increased, or do you really think that people are really starting to get aware and care about these issues and that the market's just responding to that?
Don't even get me started on the marketing. That's a whole other hour show. I mean, on all the greenwash out there and the phony green products. But I do really believe that it is also an indication that, yeah, companies are aware that we are looking for more natural products, not just women, but guys too. And so you are seeing more, you know, not just unisex brands, but also brands geared to guys, that are slapping the natural organic label on there, and you want to make sure that it's actually legit, because there's, you know, they're taking advantage of, in many cases, people who, you know, really do want to use more natural products, but they fudge their credentials, the brands fudge their credentials. So I think, the Environmental Defense Report on toxins in men's body care was awesome, and I wrote about it in Ecoholic, and I have it on my blog too. I have some added tips on not only on the report, but on, you know, okay, so you want to get rid of your shaving cream, you want to get rid of your Head and Shoulders, here are some alternatives, and there are more options available out there for guys, so that's a good thing. But you know what, and in the past I have found that, you know, even a lot of environmental guys will say, even environmentalists that, you know, are working in the field, they'll say, yeah, you know, I'm totally green in so many other ways, but then they're using Speed Stick and Irish Spring soap, and it's just, you know, people just don't think about it, because it's kind of second nature. So I think I love the fact that Environmental Defense came out and said, you know what, guys, we got to scoop out the dirt, dig in the dirt, and find out what's actually in our body care. And the truth is that, you know, you might just be using, you feel like you're using only a couple of products a day, you know, your bar of Ivory soap or whatnot, but there are a lot of hidden chemicals in there too. And so I would really recommend that I think there are more guys paying attention to this stuff, but I think that if you jump on my website again, one final push to Ecoholic.ca, you'll see I talk about some of these alternatives and some of the toxins in men's care. And the good news is that, you know, more people across genders, across age ranges, across class, across race and culture, are paying attention to the hidden toxins that are in our everyday products and the environmental ramifications that they have too. So it's really great to see. And you know what? I wouldn't be able to write a 480-page book if there weren't a lot of alternatives and options on the table right now. So that's a good sign for sure.
Absolutely. Well, I'm afraid we're out of time, but thank you so much for joining us today, Adria Vassal of Ecoholic. And people should go and check out, look in quality bookstores and probably a couple shady ones for Ecoholic Body anytime now as well. I haven't taken a look at it just yet, but if it's anything like your last two works, I'm sure it's fantastic. So thank you very much.
Yeah, definitely support your independent bookstores first this holiday season if you're looking to stock up on the copies of Ecoholic Body. We want to keep them in business first and foremost.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us.
Have a good day.
Okay, take care. And that again was Adria Vassal of Ecoholic fame. And as I mentioned just before that, if you missed the beginning of the interview, she has given us a copy of her book. I haven't received it yet. As soon as I have it in my mailbox, we'll be giving that away. So someone will get a free Christmas present, or maybe you'll just be greedy and keep it for yourself. That's all good. Do what you like with it. We're going to take a quick music break right now, and then we'll be back. Leah's going to join me. Michael's going to join me as well. And we're going to toss around a little bit of stuff about Doha. I've got some fun clips from YouTube that'll probably drive a couple people nuts in the most entertaining possible way. All this and more coming up right after this music break. Stay tuned.
Before this year is over, I'll make my peace and you'll dry your tears. So laugh and throw your sorrow, and do just what you want. nothing gained and nothing lost. And when I die, you'll find me behind the past and where we're going, the sign and cross, your worries into a fog, into
we are back. I'm Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority. The first part of the show there, we were hearing from Adria Vassil. You can go and check our website a few hours after the show if you're listening live to see a copy of that up there. If in case you missed the feature, she was talking about her book, Ecoholic Body, which will be in the bookstores now as well. I like promoting her because she's local Toronto and does good work. And she's kind of like a local here. I don't know. I've always read Ecoholic and even been a fan of that as well, Leah.
Yes, yes, I've definitely read her articles too, and she's a great writer as well. So she's very, very interesting, and she's great.
I think one of the fun things about that is that you can tell from the interview, we've had her on the show before as well, but it's just one of those people that that's sort of very honest about the way that things are, right? And she's not gonna, right. She has all these suggestions for you, but at the same point, she's not thinking that anyone that doesn't do every single thing on the list is like an evil person about that. You know, it's very much this idea that everybody does what they can, and if you can make some decisions here or some decisions there, that's great, and everyone just kind of take part. And I really do think that's the right attitude, which is why I like talking to her so much. Anyhow, we're gonna move on now to some of our Doha commentary. Just a reminder as well that you can get all the content and everything on the website after the show. And I spent quite a few hours yesterday pimping it up. It actually has fake snow. So if for no other reason, go and check the fake snow on our website, which will be on there until December 4th. A little bit of that's about as festive as I tend to get. I'm not a terribly festive person. I hate to rain on anybody's parade. But let's move on to now for some stuff about Doha as well. I have Michael McDougall sitting at a mic at the ready. Leah Mazzolini is, of course, in the studio with him as well. And what I just wanted to talk about a little bit about that is, of course, we do have Doha still going on. A couple of main articles that jumped out at us. Well, of course, we've got a long list if you want the full list on the Twitter feed going out of all the ongoing coverage of Doha. But just a couple of things that jumped out at me. One of them One of the first ones was one talking about how geoengineering was not terribly popular at Doha, and some really interesting points that were made as well from that article, which a number of issues. One was just that overall it's not very popular at the climate talks, which I'm glad to hear. I think that's fantastic. I think that I'm a huge technophile. I really like gadgets. I think that if we put our minds to it, we can probably accomplish just about anything. But the but there is that when we do when us as a human species does amazing technological things, it's usually done at a very slow and careful pace. I really doubt that we would have had much success with space travel if it had if it had been the 1920s and there had been a we need to get off this planet or we're doomed. I'm not sure how successful that would have been. And this whole geoengineering thing seems like a very, very beyond what we sort of have a firm grasp of. Attempt, and it's just very dangerous, and it's not that there's any good reason to think that it necessarily would have disastrous outcomes for sure. The point is that we're basically the point is, from my perspective at least, is that we're basically if you get into start geoengineering, you're basically rolling the dice for another climate change. I mean, there's a variety of outcomes. One of them is that it works and everything goes wonderfully, and then hooray, everyone's happy and great, and the world goes back to consuming and everybody's happy. That's only one of four outcomes. Another outcome is that it actually super backfires and makes climate change worse, and we have negative environmental repercussions from, for instance, one of the idea was putting a whole bunch of sulfates into the atmosphere to absorb heat and reflect carbon. That could not only not work, but just thinking of sulfates, I was reading some of my eco-friendly body wash this morning when I was in the shower, so I was trying to wake up. And one of the big things there is sulfate-free. And as many people who are aware of body products, and if you've read Adria Vassell's book already, they're aware that sulfates aren't necessarily a terribly good thing for us to be doing anything with. Another one is chucking a whole bunch of iron and filings into the ocean. Again, even if it succeeds in its intended tasks, the assumption that there are no consequences of that is just orders of magnitude more stupid than not doing anything about climate change at all.
I'm going to jump in and interrupt
go ahead,
you and
please.
Say, I think the human species, to your point, is very good at... is very good at coming up with interesting and novel solutions to challenges. We aren't very good at anticipating long-term consequences, though. So even if some of these issues work in the short term, the long-term repercussions could serve us more poorly than the situation we find ourselves in right now. The idea of geoengineering is really very interesting. It conjures up images of Montgomery Burns and a giant mirror to reflect the sun, right? Which is super cool and hilarious, but it's also hilarious because it's so absurd. The whole idea makes me think of three things. It makes me think of Total Recall, where Arnold Schwarzenegger goes to Mars and they melt the polar ice caps to release all the oxygen, and then he miraculously manages to, spoiler alert, breathe and live at the end of the movie, which is so far flung and neglects to consider so many factors that, of course, it's short-sighted. It is Hollywood. The second thing it makes me think of is invasive species. Whenever the human species has tried to experiment with our economy by introducing species into other climates, beavers into South America, for instance, to feed the Hudson Bay Company's desire for beaver pelts, they failed in so many different ways. And now in Argentina and Buenos Aires, there are giant beavers that produce lousy fur because the climate isn't suitable to producing good fur. And yet these 8-foot-long beavers are building dams that are wreaking havoc on all of their human-made infrastructure. So there's a failing right there. The third thing that it makes me think about is that here we are looking at a problem and considering addressing it by doing more rather than less, mm-hmm. when the more in the first place is what caused the problem. So perhaps we should re-examine our philosophy.
Yeah, no, and I think one of the things that from the article that we're referencing, and I apologize, I don't have the paper that it's from in front of me, but it will be linked after the show if you want to read the article that we're referring to, is that it was actually an outcome I hadn't considered, Michael, which is that we have the it works scenario, we have the it doesn't work scenario, and there's a variety of caveats having to do with either one of those. The one that I hadn't really thought of, which they bring up in the article, which is sort of the worst case scenario, is that it appears to work, and therefore everybody stops worrying about reducing mm-hmm. all these things, and then it fails. And what would happen there is that not only would that waste a whole bunch of time of us actually creating real solutions, in addition to that, possibly encourage all the negative things we're doing, thinking we've now have a solution for it, and who cares, now we get away scot-free, but that this would actually encourage not just that we would still get climate change, but that it would be worse, was that it would sort of hold it back a little bit. And it's sort of like, imagine the idea of like sort of building up a dam a little bit higher.
Yeah, we just escalate.
You've bought yourself a bit of time. Is that when the dam breaks, you now have more damage, and because of that, I won't go through a whole climate science lesson today, but we talk about peaks and valleys. There's like little valleys where climate can kind of settle. You know, it's think about it as like a series of rungs, right? And so there's a little bit of play within it, but when they talk about runaway climate change, what they're talking about is it kind of, you know, the climate can settle in an area and it will vary back and forth a little bit, but then it can go up. And so say the temperature hovers around 2 degrees, well, then it will, you know, goes to the next level. Well, then now the comfort kind of zone is that it could settle at around 4 degrees. What could happen with this huge buildup is that we essentially jump over to the next one, and now we're talking about because we misunderstood the things and that this wasn't the natural cycle, therefore all of our previous research doesn't really apply, that we could, when it breaks, not only deal with the damage that would have been done if we hadn't done anything, but it would be like exponentially worse, not just a little bit worse, not just a little bit delayed, not a little bit of lost time, but basically a game over scenario.
It's to that point, when they've done all sorts of psychological clinical trials on people and their behavior, and an example could be people on diets who, after having a salad for lunch instead of a steak or something fatty, then have given themselves license, or discover in themselves license, to eat the cookie in the middle of the afternoon. So here, to your point, if we implement some of these new technologies or new ideas, it gives us license to burn more fossil fuels or to consume more water or to do whatever else it is that was causing the problem, and then, as you say, could potentially throw out all of the value that we've derived from solar power technologies or from increasing fuel efficiency of our machinery, etc.
That's actually a perfect perfect segue to the first clip that I want to play.
You're welcome.
Thank you. That was totally not rehearsed, I promise. So what we're talking about there, where I kind of wanted to go with that, was that, we have this discussion, people saying about, well, you know, should we or should we not have, you know, the tar sands in Alberta and all this and that. And every single time I see a news article about, well, drilling, or could we afford to do this, or people sort of saying, well, you know, renewable energy isn't there yet, so for the time being, we've got to drill more. Okay, let's get one fact kind of clear. And I think this is the most critical fact having to do with this idea, which is that, according to the best science, we already have in reserves, already piped, already drilled, already found, we've got it, ready to go, 4 times more oil than we can afford to burn without passing that dangerous 2-degree warming, where after then it could, you know, go 6, 8, 10, 15, and we're in real, real, real trouble. So we already cannot burn what we've got. No question about it. There's no uncertainty about it. Very, very hard science saying we can't afford to burn what we've already got. So anytime anyone says anything about more drilling, it's like, well, there's really no conversation to be had here, because we already can't burn it. We can't burn it, so why are we looking for more, right? It really doesn't make any sense. So on that note, we're going to go to a clip, and I just want to make very careful to kind of frame what the intention of this clip was here, because I don't want to risk getting dragged into a conversation I wasn't planning on having. This is a clip by Brian Fisher. Brian Fisher is a talk show host, a right-wing host in the south of the U.S. I'm just going to go ahead and say right now that he's an all-around nut job. Is super, hates gay people and hates women's rights and just an absolute backwards jerk. However, I think it's important because, unfortunately, there are segments of the population, and this exists here in Canada too, we just don't see it as often, that listen to this. And the reason I wanted to bring this up, specifically, Michael, to your point, was that we're talking here about facts. And facts are really cool, and facts help us make good decisions, but there are a lot of people who do not make their decision based on facts. And they wouldn't see it that way. But their argument is generally like an emotional argument, or I don't, you know, it's the argument from ignorance, which is that, you know, I don't see how that could be true, therefore it isn't. So anyway, with that caveat of just saying that we will have a people person here, the clip is it's on a show where its main basis is a religion. I just wanted to be clear for our listeners. I'm not playing this because I want to have a discussion about religion. What I'm looking for to get from this is a conversation about how things like religion, ideologies, can be misused by people, because I don't see how it's possible that anyone could seriously hold this point of view. This guy just really seems to me to be a mouthpiece for major industry and companies. Interestingly enough, the guest that he's talking to, Dr. Calvin Besner, is from the Cornwall Institute, which I actually wrote a paper on when I was in university. That's a super right-wing think tank that basically his only job is to deny climate change, and they're all funded by Koch brothers and all those nice folks down there. So anyway, with my super long caveat, I just wanted to make sure that people understood the context of where we're going with this. We'll go to that clip, and we'll come back for comment.
Let me just connect that to a biblical parable, the parable of the talents. The unfaithful steward, the wicked and lazy steward, as the master calls him, was the one who buried his talent in the ground and didn't do anything with it to multiply it. That's essentially what those who say we need to stop using oil, coal, and natural gas are telling us to do. Just leave those resources buried in the ground rather than pulling them out and multiplying their value for human benefit.
You know, I remember one time, Cal, this just flashed into my head, a birthday party when I was a young guy. I was probably, I don't know, six or something like that. And I opened up a birthday present that I didn't like. And I said it right out, oh, I don't like those. You know, and it just crushed. And the person that gave me the gift was there. You know, I just kind of blurted it out. I don't like those. And, you know, I just crushed that person. And, you know, it was enormously insensitive of me to do that. And you think, well, that's kind of how we're treating God when he's given us these gifts of abundant and inexpensive and effective fuel sources.
Right.
And we don't thank him for it and we don't use it. You know, the scripture said it is the glory of God to conceal a matter. It's the glory of kings to search it out.
Yeah.
And so part of what God, you know, God's buried those treasures there because he loves to see us find them and put them to use.
Right. So if you're just tuning in, just so you don't mistake, this is not a replay of the Brian Fisher Show. This is not Focal Point. But that was a clip from Focal Point. And again, the reason I wanted to bring that up was that, you know, when we're having conversations about facts and what we should do about those facts, it should be simply acknowledged, which is why I played that clip, that there is a portion of a significant portion, maybe not a majority, maybe not even a huge percentage, but there is a portion of the voting public who makes decisions based on things other than facts. And you know, emotional arguments, or you know, whether it happens to be in this case a sort of God-related argument, which I don't even buy for a second anyway. I think he's just saying that because he's getting a paycheck from Koch brothers, but. Which is an assertion, by the way. I don't have any evidence for that. But the guy at Cornwall Alliance, who Dr. Calvin Besner works for, does definitely have links to large industry groups. And I just sort of wanted to toss that up for comment. I'm going to go to Leah first because we haven't heard from you yet. But just about, you know, either a comment on the clip itself. I mean, I think we can all agree it's absurd. But or the point itself to which, you know, how do we access people who, you know, they don't care what our facts are because that's not what they're making their decision based on. How do we work with that?
Well, that's really tricky. I mean, you'd have to change how they think and how what their belief systems are, because ultimately, if their belief systems are going to dictate what they believe in, what they take in as valid information, unless they change that, then there's really no way to really get them kind of to see scientific facts, because to them they don't actually. Acknowledge them as being valid. They use their faith and what they believe in, not what they know, but what they believe in as what's valid. So it's very difficult to really kind of, in a way, change their minds. Like,
I think one of the things, and I don't mean to pick on him while he's not here, but you know, I'm gonna anyway. A good friend of the show and a friend of mine, Dr. Stephen Sharper, Professor Stephen Sharper. I'm throwing Dr. around willy nilly. Professor Stephen Sharper here at the University of Toronto. Good friend of mine, friend of the show. He's been on numerous times. I have a huge amount of respect for him. But one area where we have always sort of disagreed was he is a big fan of a lot of faith-based environment groups. I definitely have to acknowledge that they do a lot of good. But my sort of counter to that is that religion in this sense, and again, and I'm using kind of small r and big r religion at the same time, but is that it's sort of a null factor, because you know, you get people who sort of want to be selfish, and therefore they're more prone to Dr. Brian or Brian Fisher's sort of point of view, or there's people who want to do environment stuff because they think it's the right thing to do and then do it. I don't, in my opinion, the religion doesn't really play a factor, but it is important to understand the language by which people use and the way in which to interact people. You know, you sort of said there as a throwaway, we have to change people's worldviews. That's, you know, I would say that's more difficult than climate change. We're talking about the fundamental way in which people organize their lives. They're not going to, you know, even if they went in and we found, we took Stephen Sharper to them and throw them into them, he's not going to convince them, even even though he can make a compelling faith-based argument for his point of view, which is the complete opposite of Brian Fisher's. And I don't know. I kind of played this because I don't really have an answer for that. I don't know how we address that. Maybe the solution is not having them at the table and just ignoring them. I don't know. Michael, do you think, is this something where you think there's some area where we could potentially bring these folks over, or should we just proceed without them and just ignore them for now as irrelevant?
Well, to, you know, add a postmodern spin to this, our shared perspective in this room that facts should be considered more primarily than faith or ideology is itself an ideology.
Oh, and fair enough.
So we have these two competing sets of ideology. My ideology is that we as humans are not the center of the universe, and consequently not everything was created for our benefit and our use. So we should probably leave some of the oil buried in the ground. But this gentleman that we played a couple of minutes ago has a very different perspective on the world, and that everything is here in place for human consumption, human use, human benefit. I humbly disagree. Ultimately, if you can change people's ideologies, if you can change their mindset and the way they consider facts and information and emotions, you will win a lot of elections. So honestly, bottle it, sell it if you come up with it.
So I mean, maybe Stephen Sharper's approach is the way to go, that just try to put as much positive vibe out there within the language and sort of within the type of argument that those folks are more subject to. And again, I'm not asserting an abject, say, relativistic superiority of facts, but when it comes down to doing stuff, facts are demonstrably the way to go.
But I see your point, though. If the conversation is a faith-based conversation about the consumption of resources, then someone with a faith-based perspective or worldview is more likely to be swayed or influenced by opposing arguments from within that same faith-based rubric or frame of consideration, right? So if to oppose this gentleman's perspective, we offer up the idea that perhaps stewardship of our environment and the all the beasts and animals, etc., then that would, as I say, likely have more influence on these people's perspectives than just saying, no, consider facts instead of your belief in God and the world.
Okay. We actually, I just looked at my clock and we ate up way more time with that discussion than I'd anticipated. We did have another really quick clip, but I think it was something that was mirroring more or less the points we've already made. So we'll just move on for now. I'm going to go to a really quick music break. We won't even play the full song because I've got one more interview I want to sneak into the rest of the show. So we'll pause now for a quick music break and stay tuned. We'll be back in like 1 minute with our final interview.
This old river has caught all the tears I've cried. This old river taught me how he lied. This old river, Lord, it makes me blue.
That again was music programmed by DJ Amber Waves, who's doing all the music for the show. This is all Canadian content, local bands, whether it be from Toronto or from Canada. So you can check out our website for reviews of that music, or you can go ahead and just go straight to the mouth of the person who wrote it. I don't know. I was going somewhere with that. Anyway, you can go directly to Amber's website, which is the Open Till Midnight blog. We're going to go to Leah now for a really quick news roll, and then we're going to come back for our final interview of the show. Leah, take it away.
Yeah, thanks, Darren. First Nation chiefs are showing their displeasure with several measures of the new omnibus bill, C-45. Environment Minister Peter Kent says no to a Cenovus energy gas project in Alberta. The Committee on the Status of Endangered Wildlife in Canada says bats and snakes are now part of the list. And after 10 years on the run, a BC eco-radical suspect surrenders. On the other side of the pond, protests in the UK ignite over fears of the fracking ban will lift. In Burma, courts charge protesters over a court mine protest. And in Brazil, Brazilians, Indians visit the capital to protest invasions of tribal lands by loggers and ranchers. And a new study show global warming will likely drown New Orleans, New York, and other low-lying U.S. cities. And according to the World Energy Council report, energy systems are now still far from being sustainable. All these stories and more are posted on our Twitter feed at Green Majority.
All right. Thank you, Leanne. Of course, we've added a whole bunch of new content. There's a bunch of ways to stay in contact with the show. One of the great ones, as Leah was just saying there, is those are just a small sampling of the news stories that we put out on our Twitter feed and on our Facebook. There's tons and tons of content, more than I could ever even possibly hope to read all of it myself. I just sort of pretend to. I do read as much as I can, but there's just too much stuff. But it allows you to kind of skim through and read the stuff you're interested in. And we do a really wide variety. So if you like arts and culture environment related stuff, we got that. I have amusing cartoons that I put up on our Facebook page as much as often as possible from a variety of sources, lots of news stories, discussion, all sorts of stuff. Please add your comments. It's meant as a public forum, so go ahead, put comments, see what you think. We don't always put stuff up there because we agree with it. Sometimes I put it up because I don't know how I feel about it or because I disagree with it. So go ahead and jump on that as well. I should also note that yesterday I added to our website a calendar. You can go to that with the Connect With Us button on the website. And what that is for now it's just a schedule for the show. But what we'd like people to do is we're going to be adding some events ourselves. But if you have any event, we're just going to limit it to Toronto for now. So I do apologize to the rest of Ontario and the rest of the country. But for now, Toronto only. If you have events, anything that's going on that is environmental related, you think either our listeners should know about or you would like us to attend, either myself or Leo or someone else from the show, go ahead and you can invite us with the calendar, which you just use our email address, thegreenmajority@dml.com. You use your Google Calendar to invite us to that event. It will actually automatically show up publicly on our calendar. And so that way, that allows us to consider whether or not we can possibly come. Of course, we always love to come to stuff. It's a matter of whether or not we can, because unfortunately, you don't get paid for this, right?
I don't get paid. No.
No, as far as I can tell, we're all volunteers, so we do have real jobs, unfortunately, but we do our best to try and get out to as many things as possible. So if you have an event, anything going on, large or small, big gala event for environmental defense all the way down to a local meetup for just a couple of folks, go ahead, throw it on the calendar. We'll make sure that other people know about it, and we'll do our best to attend that ourselves as well. If you missed any of that, or if there's anything else I forgot to mention, all of it's up on the website, so just go ahead and go to greenmajority.ca. We're running really close on time here, so I'm going to go straight to our last feature, which is Dr. Mary Brunig, who's Associate Professor of Recreation and Leisure Studies at Brock University, talking about the correlation between education and respect for the environment. Take it away. We are speaking today to Dr. Mary Brunig, who has a PhD in education and is currently teaching in a post-secondary classroom as the Associate Professor in the Department of Recreation and Leisure Studies at Brock University in St. Catharines. Welcome to the Green Majority, Mary.
Thanks.
So we would like to speak to you today because of an article that you had in Alternatives Journal that was dealing with ESP. And no, we're not talking about psychic powers. In this case, we're talking about environmental studies programs. You are a professional education, an educator professional, if you will, because in addition to having taught at many levels within the school system, you also, your PhD, as I said, is in education, and spend a lot of time thinking about how we learn. And so what you were talking about in the article that I'd like to discuss with you today was some studies that you've been doing, some research about how people learn and how courses like environment courses that have been removed over the past many years of sort of educational condensation, if you will, cutting, if you want to look at it one way, is that we've lost a lot of these like outdoor programs and this sort of thing. And so you went to study what sort of the effects that outdoor education and environment education had on younger students. Do you want to just outline a little bit, if I missed anything about your study that was there, and then you can tell us a little bit about what the results were.
Yeah, so most specifically what I look at with this particular study, and I have a number of studies I'm engaged in, but with this particular study, it's quite targeted. And there currently exists 33 integrated environmental studies programs across Ontario. And what they do is they offer a grouping of courses as a package, and students study in a cohort. So they study, and it's secondary school students, and they study essentially living in a cohort and learning the four-credit package in a holistic way, and it's usually taught by one or two teachers. Some of the programs do it at the school site. Other programs actually get on a school bus in the morning and go out to a camp or a nature center and study off-site. And the specific focus of the study is to look at what environmental knowledges do students learn in these programs, but more specifically and more interestingly, how does that translate to what we call pro-environmental behaviors? And
And that can run the gamut from domestic behaviors like recycling, water usage, to more emancipatory behaviors, and issues of food security and where your food comes from, and issues of social and environmental justice. And so that's specifically what we look at, is not just the knowledges that students learn, but how that translates into pro-environmental action. And then we do retrospective data collection on these programs because they've been around for over 30 years. And we look at and talk to students who have been, who were in these programs over the course of those 30 years, to find out which of those environmental behaviors have kind of stuck and how their program participation has impacted their professional pathways and life choices and lifestyles.
One of the things that you talk about in the article is student reactions and sort of peer reactions to these younger students. In some cases, you know, people, other students mocking them, saying that they're being, you know, oh, when are you going to do some real work? You guys are just kind of walking around outside, you know, while we have math homework and that sort of thing. And we've also covered on in previous interviews as well a similar case, but with adults, where adults, had sort of self-reported that they felt weird about doing things or embarrassed about doing things like recycling because it wasn't perceived as being cool. And they thought that their peers would judge them, even, you know, even as adults, they were sort of subject to this. What sort of a factor do you think that this plays into people's both sort of acceptance of this sort of program as something that should be presented to children and as environmentalism in general, the factor of peer pressure?
Yeah. And I think what we're starting to see more and more is actually peer pressure in trending in the opposite direction of what you're describing. It actually, I think, has become uncool for young people to not recycle. What you're speaking about, adults, really resonates. But I actually think that younger people now are just, this is the new norm, especially in Canada. And if they see a friend throw, you know, a bag of trash out the window, they call them out on it, even if they're not in these programs, is what I experience. But I think the claim that you're making around peers sort of looking at the course as a course that is sort of less rigorous is a challenging one. And often these courses and outdoor courses in general in schools, including universities, are sort of referred to as bird courses.
Mm-hmm.
And
ironically,
and so, yeah, and staff and teachers and faculty often sort of describe them in the same way. So it's not just coming from peers; it's also coming from other people within the schools. And what happens is, I think a lot of the teachers of these programs kind of develop what we call in my discipline the lone wolf syndrome. So they sort of see themselves or start to self-identify as kind of a lone wolf. Part of how they sort of sustain themselves in these programs is to just, to really just, the engagement that they get from the students and the experiences that they share with them are so nurturing that they're able to kind of overcome some of those other feelings of being the other. And I think students experience the same thing. A lot of the students in the programs are students that are athletes, and maybe they have to make a choice if they're in the program because there's a lot of field courses in these environmental studies programs that they may not be able to play soccer a particular semester, but they start to believe so fully in what they're doing in the program that they report missing it or anticipating missing it pre-program commencement, but post-program, it hardly even registers for them.
So just with respect to what the actual research that you're doing is for, you have a few choice words in there, as we sort of alluded to earlier, about the stripping down of education and the reimagining of it with, you know, stripped down and we're losing everything. You know, we have basic math classes and that sort of thing, but things that used to involve outdoor. Richard Louv, you mentioned there as well, of nature deficit disorders coming from these sort of stripping down of the regular curriculum. Do you intend to use, is this research sort of intended to advocate for policy? Or are you just looking to educate individuals? Or what exactly is the hope you have for this?
Well, it's a variety of things. Some of it is to motivate people to think more about this. And a piece of it is definitely to start to establish, because there's anecdotal evidence that sort of suggests that we assume that an increase in environmental knowledge just leads to environmental behaviors. And what we're learning is that that's not necessarily the case, depending upon how a piece of curriculum is taught, who's teaching it, the school context, whether it's rural or urban, peer pressure, parental pressure, all these various factors, socioeconomic status, are all affecting which knowledges get translated into which behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
So part of it is to generate some outcomes-based research to really support reintegrating environmental education into the K-12 classroom. And not necessarily in this form, or not necessarily as a standalone course, but a little bit like community service learning, which is also kind of a big buzzword and is gaining popularity. And to have it be something that's integrated into various courses where appropriate. So rather than have it be kind of a standalone course, to integrate it into a biology course, integrate it into secondary science education, physical education, leadership, and some of the ministry requirements that currently exist. And to perhaps package it alternatively, as this course does, but also just to think about the ways in which we can just integrate this in a more fluid way, cross-curricularly. I've just been in contact with the Ministry of Education. So I've been to ministry symposium and presented my research, and I'm just now beginning conversations with them, now that I have a bit more data and some results to share, to ask them what kind of potential collaborations there are, and to also ask them the kind of research and the kind of ways in which I might be able to use the data to support environmental education initiatives in schools.
Mm-hmm. Well, if this does end up turning into some sort of a movement, if you get some some sort of action where you're looking for support, please do keep us posted of the developments. I think there's a lot of we do have a lot of educators that listen to this program, as well as the educated students. So I think you'll find a lot of sympathy within our audience. So it would be our pleasure to have you back on if you had any new research you want to discuss or anything. For the time being, however, that is all the time we have for. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Mary Breinig, for joining the Green Majority today.
Thank you.
All right, so we're out of time, folks. Thank you very much for joining us. I've been Darren Kaster. You have been listening to the Green Majority, and have yourselves a great week, and we'll see you next week. Thanks so much.